Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's a pet care day on the show. And we'll be talking about maybe training your dog or working with your pet. With our guest, George Malara, back with us, professional dog trainer, owner of Divine Canine in Madison. George has trained dogs for more than 20 years, been a pet behavior counselor. He also volunteers his time and skill with other not-for-profit organizations and rescue groups as well. So he does a lot of wonderful work. And as we talk with him today, I was thinking about the holidays, and here we've got lots of holidays. Christmas coming right up, and you're going to have people visiting.
Lots of variables.
Yes, indeed. Welcome, George, by the way.
Thank you for having me again, buddy.
And as we talk with George, I hope you'll join in. Does your dog greet unfamiliar people? Do you have difficulty controlling that four-legged friend? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. George, let's talk about jumping dogs to begin with. The holidays, you know, lots of visitors coming to people's homes. Many dogs react by jumping up on a stranger.
Or jumping on counters and thinking impure thoughts about the roasted turkey. So when we talk about these behaviors, it really lumps into like two categories. You either have dogs that have been trained, that know what to do and how to behave, and then you have dogs that are still young to the family, or they might not have the skill set that it takes, especially with the excitement of having all the family coming by. And, you know, our guests can also throw gas on the fire, right? Nobody comes in the house and goes, oh, what a nice dog. They go, oh, Sparky, what's going on? And they get very excited. So the dogs get excited. So there's a lot to talk about in terms of management versus training. Because I believe it's going to be the 24th tomorrow. You're not going to get a whole lot of obedience training done in a day.
No.
But then that's where management's your friend, you know, taking out the crate if your dog is comfortable in a crate, making sure that you have all your toys that can be stuffed with yummy stuff in it. Luck favors the prepared. So being prepared with all that stuff before Christmas dinner, Christmas Eve dinner, depending on how you celebrate. But having that stuff ready to rock so that when everything goes down, you'll be better prepared.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, let's assume that this doesn't happen like it should, and we get a lot of dogs jumping up, and the person says, oh, why didn't I train my dog? What are the ways to get your dog not to jump up on people for the long term?
So the big thing that I love to teach is the first one is just feeding your dog for just sitting or laying down in front of you. Remember, oftentimes we say no to the behavior we don't want, but we don't take the time to teach the yes behavior, which is sitting, laying down, and not jumping up. The other part that goes missing is introducing distractions. So the dog can do it in the sterility of your living room, but the moment Uncle Jim comes in, he goes, oh, there's my dog, hey, there's my buddy, right? That's a distraction, so the dog gets excited and is more likely to jump. So in your training, you have to incorporate stress and distractions to really test the dog. I play it like a Simon Says type game, right? I'll pat my chest a little bit, who's your bushy baby? And if the dog doesn't jump, I say, yes, good boy, and I give him a treat. If they jump, I'll cross my arms and turn around and ignore them, showing them that jumping up wasn't the right response.
Makes a lot of sense to me, but you have to do this. Just one time isn't going to work.
You know what? I did one sit-up, and I did not have abs. Yes, you got to do a lot of ab workout. You got to do a lot of training to get that dog to where you want him to be. Training is not a one-off event. It's practice. You know, people look at my dogs or people's dogs that have really invested the time, and it's like that iceberg analogy. They're only seeing the finished product. People have no idea the thousands of hours that some people put into their dogs to really get them to where they are, and you can take them places and go do all these fun things.
Yeah. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tom in River Falls with us and has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I am glad to talk to you. My question is this. I've had dogs all my life, and I'm 73 years old. And I want to know, George, what is your take on training using electric shock collars?
Completely against it. And the reason being is, and I'm just going to quote Ian Dunbar on this one. To use a shock collar effectively, you need three things. You need a thorough understanding of learning theory and the science, the principles of learning theory. Mm-hmm. You need to have a really thorough understanding of dog body language and dog behavior. And you need impeccable timing. And if you have those three things, you don't need a shock collar.
So you know that.
So and you also think about the fallout. You know, think about those. You're watching television. And you see those commercials on TV. You see a pretty lady on a horse on a beach riding a horse, and it's like the medicine commercial, right? For whatever illness you have. My favorite are the side effects. Limb loss, blindness, all these horrible side effects. And when you use equipment like that, that's what you end up with. There's a lot of side effects. With shock collars, you end up suppressing behavior. And when you suppress the behavior, the dog is still left with not knowing what they're supposed to do, what the yes behavior is. And it's, again, that quick fix, the fad diets. It's people want results really quickly, but there's no substitute for hard work. And relationship building with your dog.
Yeah. So you're the kind of the opposite.
I would shock collars. They can go in the trash.
Yeah.
There's no need for them.
And your approach is positive.
Positive reinforcement based training. So whenever the dog does something favorable that I like, I give them food. Food is the best currency to work with. And I bump into people all the time like, well, I don't want my dog to become dependent on food. Guess what, buddy? the damn dog's got to eat,
yeah.
Right? So we want to make sure that we use food correctly. Now, even in the realm of learning in the two positive reinforcement camps, you have luring, and that's when you take a cookie, just like a fishing lure, and you move it around, and the dog goes into a sit or lure them out down onto the floor to get into a down position. And not that luring is like the evil Darth Vader of dog training, but what happens is that the dog ends up becoming dependent on the lure because people don't fade it out. You should only lure a couple times, get rid of the lure, and see if they can do it on their own. The other thing I don't like about luring is that sometimes when used incorrectly, you create a stagnant dog. The dog will sit there and go, I'll do whatever you want, but you got to give me the answers. So you're giving the answers to the homework. So I much rather people use clicker training or shaping. There's a brilliant website called clickertraining.com, Karen Pryor's website.
Yeah.
Brilliant woman. She's really led so many trained so many wonderful trainers. But anything on her website's gold. It's so valuable. And those techniques are really important. So you have a marker, the click or the yes. And then you deliver food. So your dog ends up, it's a cooperative effort between you and your dog where they're sitting there, you have the food, and they're like, how do I get Larry to say yes? Offer behavior. And then Larry from his throne says yes and gives him a treat for a behavior. And the dog starts to go, wait a second, it has something to do with me laying down. And they start to puzzle through. Not only is this more expensive to use their brain, right? They have to use a lot of their brain to figure it out. But you're building a relationship, and you're working on that relationship. It's a teamwork. It's like those rally drivers.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. So let's talk a bit more about the guests themselves. I mean, is there, before the guests arrive, can there be a little training involved with the guests?
Of course, you can. And it's also, like I said before, luck favors the prepared. So let's say Christmas dinners, you know, people are going to trickle in at around noon, Christmas dinners at, you know, 3-ish. Taking that dog for either, like, if your dog does well and thrives at the dog park, going to the dog park, going for a big monster walk, really, really getting him that physical tired, and then having the enrichment toys, which will fill another pocket of activity, which is just getting them mentally tired, and then just doing a little bit of training beforehand. So the training I would involve in is called, one of the games I teach is called the elevator game. Dog is sitting in front of you, and then imagine if there was a thread going from the top of the dog's head up to the ceiling, and we lower a treat on that invisible thread. If the dog goes to jump for the treat, you pull the treat away. I like to put it on my shoulder with the same shoulder of the hand that I'm holding it. Pull the treat away for the count of five. That's the punishment. Oh, you jumped up. You don't get the treat. And then the dog sits and fixes it. Then we try again. The goal is to get closer and closer to their face without them jumping. So that they're understanding, like, no matter what's going on, don't jump up. And you can play a similar game with just touching. So many times you'll be petting a dog, and the moment you stop petting, the dog says, engage launch sequence, right? And they jump. So instead, what I teach is we pet the dog, and then we stop petting for a fraction of a second. Good boy. And then we keep petting. If they jump up, we ignore. So the dog is left with that black and white information. If you jump, you don't get any more attention. But if you remain with 4 feet on the floor, I'll continue to touch you.
I like that. That's a pretty good advice. Michael emailed to say his daughter has a 4-year-old dog that looks a little bit like a Bichon and is the sweetest dog on earth. But when there are new people in the house and she gets excited, she has to have something in her mouth like a toy. If she doesn't have a toy, then she will grab onto your pants leg. Is there a way of ending this behavior? Michael has tried leaving dog toys outside the house, so if somebody happens to stop by, she will grab the toy and not the pant leg.
It is one of my favorite behaviors when a dog goes and collects a toy. It's almost they know that they have to self-soothe and by picking up that toy. I love the idea of leaving toys out for her. I didn't catch if it's a male or a female, but we'll say her. But
she is.
So when people arrive, you could even just stuff a toy in her mouth. Be like, where's your toy? Go get a toy. Right. Prompt that behavior because it's such a lovely behavior and it's cute as hell, to be honest. I think it's so cute when dogs do that. Or they bring you a shoe or something, but having that guidance, the mouthiness, when a dog is like picking stuff up, it's like, They're trying to cope. Think of it like, you know, nail biting. They're excited. Mm-hmm. They're happy. They just don't. It's like their cup is overflowing. They need something to do, so they have to pick up a toy. But you can prompt her by saying, "Go get your toy. Go get your toy before you say hello," and send them off to go get a toy.
Love it. Is it ever a good idea to keep a dog leashed inside the house before?
It really depends on the dog. It really depends on the dog, Larry. Some dogs will get more frustrated. Yeah. And going back to what we were talking about before, where people train in the sterility of their living room, one of the things that I do when we talk about like that petting game, pet the dog, stop petting, pet them, we start to play tug and it create what I call synthetic arousal. It's synthetic because I'm creating it. But what I want the dog to do is be able to think when they're aroused. So when you're home with your dog and you're just hanging out, the dog's great. But the moment somebody new comes in, even if they're calm and relaxed, that can still set them off because it's like somebody vertical with a pulse. I'm so happy. And they get wild again. So introducing arousal that way. So for some dogs, being on leash is the right thing because they're just beside themselves with happiness or just really happy. And we should also, so having them on leash can prevent them from rehearsing the behavior of jumping and being mouthy and whatever else. And then for some dogs, we still have to talk about the other side of the dog spectrum, which is fearful dogs or people, yeah, or dogs that are a little nervous around people. There's a couple of great techniques that I use to help dogs feel better in that context. One of the things about having them on leash, it can just build a little bit of frustration.
Yeah.
So really teaching dogs prior to people coming over. The other thing that helps is having little gift bags right at the front door. So you make little bags of treats for all your guests that are arriving. They grab a bag on the way in and then they can immediately start feeding the dog if the dog likes people. Now, the technique I love to use around dogs that are a little bit scared of people, or if they are scared. Now, if there's any dog that has the potential to have a bite risk, I would just skip the whole greeting thing and just have that dog put away. We don't, you know, it's the holidays. We don't need any bloodshed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with fearful dogs that probably aren't a bite risk.
Here's what I love to do. So you have the top-notch, top-tier, upper echelon of treats. Chicken, cheese, turkey, roast beef, hot dogs. One of a variety. And if the dog is willing to take treats from your hands, go ahead and give it to them. You're going to give them maybe two or three, maybe four treats in a row. And then you take that next treat and you throw it way behind them so they can track it. And then they have to go away to get it. This part's really crucial because what does a fearful dog want? Space. Distance. So you're giving that to them by throwing that treat. Gives them a moment to decompress. It's also switching their brain from stranger danger to food acquisition. Now, what does that dog have to do to get more food from me? He's got to come back.
Got to come back.
So you're actually rewarding the approach, which is one of the most difficult things for fearful dogs to do. And they're going to go, hey, this guy just keeps giving me food. This is great. I'm going to keep going over there. And then that will slowly transfer over to other people. And then that's how we start building safety. But with those dogs, I really emphasize a lot about, you know, just because you paid your token entry does not mean you touched them on the head. You know, people are so quick to like give a couple treats like, oh, I gave you a treat. We're friends now. And they touch them on the head. The dog's like, I knew I shouldn't have trusted you. This guy gets all handsy.
George Malara, our guest, professional dog trainer. We're talking with him about your dog's behavior. And if you have a question, you want to join in for sure and give a call at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. George Malara, our professional dog trainer extraordinaire, with us today on the show. Again, questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I have a friend. Every time I go to her house to visit, the dog barks like crazy for a while until she calms the dog down.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's a bark before he's going to bite me. It's just barking, barking, running through the house, barking.
It's funny that you said that, like the idea of he's not barking to bite you. He's just barking. Some dogs are very vocal.
Yeah.
And I always, when people come to me and they say, oh, my dog's barking, I always bring up this. So let's say you're a Martin Scorsese and I'm your Leonardo DiCaprio. In the next scene, you tell me, okay, Leo, I'm going to need you to cry. What would I ask you?
I'd say, Leo, you need to cry.
But what would I ask you? What's my motivation?
I see.
Did my dog die? Did I stub my toe?
Gotcha.
You know? So what's my motivation? Dogs bark for a variety of different reasons, right? Perimeter breach. Oh, my God, I love you. Oh, my God, it's dinner time. Hurry up and feed me, right? They bark for a variety of reasons. So first, the job is to pinpoint why the dog is barking. In this case with your friend, it sounds like he's just excited to see Larry, right? Uncle Larry is the funmeister, and he probably brings snacks and treats. And he's a fun guy. So in those moments, what you can do is, this is one of the things I talk about, don't throw gas on the fire. When you come in, maintain low tones, be mellow, and just start feeding treats and staying cool. If you go in with the idea of, where's my buddy? There he is. Ah, and you get on the floor and you start wrestling him, he's going to bark and be excited.
So be calm, maybe have some treats.
Yep.
And there you go.
And immediately go into a little bit of training. The other thing I wanted to mention around treats, and this is sort of like dipping into a toe into the world of science and how the treats work. Because people just think you're bribing the dog, you're just feeding treats, which isn't the case. But treats have a trickle-down effect. Think of those like fancy champagne towers you would see at a wedding, where you pour it in the top glass and it trickles down to all the other glasses. So when you give your dog a treat, you're paying for the behavior right in front of you, but you're also paying for whatever happened just before that, good or bad, and whatever happened before that, even less. So the reinforcement's being spread. And I believe my clients are like, we never feed this dog for jumping. We never pay him for jumping. And I go, but what happens is dog is jumping, jumping, jumping. And you go, sit. And the dog sits. And you give the dog a treat. Good boy. And I think good sitting. And then you interview that dog later and say, hey, Sparky, do you know how to sit? He goes, of course I know how to sit. First, I jump up and I punch you in the stomach. and then I sit. And I believe them when they say we don't pay them for jumping, but you do.
Jane in Wausau has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi,
my
Jane.
My question has to do with our dog. We live in the kind of in the woods, and we like to take him for a walk off leash. When he's within sight of us, he will come back. She will come back and get her treat and stay with us. But as soon as she's out of our sight, then she's off looking on her own or hunting something down. And she comes back, but it's on her term. We'd like to get her to come back when she's called all the time. Mm.
And those behaviors are taught in the home. So, you know, the idea of her being off leash, it just ends up being unpredictable, right? You know, if you're only carrying milk bone treats that are crunchy, you know, squirrel droppings are much tastier than that. And there might be a little carcass of an animal and she's exploring and hunting. So whatever her name is, right, you're calling her and she's not coming when called. Every moment she's not coming, she's self-rewarding. So how do we build these in the house? I start off with some really basic name recognition. So, you know, this is all hands on deck. You make a sort of circle with, like, family members, mom, dad, kids, mm-hmm. whatever. And then one person's the ringleader. They're going to point to who's going to call. So I point to Larry. Larry calls the dog. The dog comes over to Larry. The first thing we do is we grab the dog's collar. We want to have possession of the dog so that they don't think that they can just dip away. Like, I came, I got my treat, and I left. It's, I have possession of the dog. And you give them some treats, and then the next person, you point, that person calls, and you're sort of just ping-ponging them back and forth in this little circle. Then after the dog starts doing really great there, you make the circle bigger. Maybe Larry goes into the living room, and Bill goes into the hallway, somebody in the kitchen, and the dog has to cover more ground to get to those people. Now, depending how attached your dog is to you, because it sounds like she does come to check in, the moments when she checks in, she should be getting jackpots of rewards. Because we want her to go, oh, wow, like, the woods is good, but, like, she's using turkey today. This is definitely a better day. So what we want to do is we want to just reinforce the yes part of the behaviors, those yes moments when she's doing the behavior correctly. And there's another game I like to play in the house. It's just it's a hide and seek with rules. So dog's off doing whatever, you hide. Now, when you hide, I want you to hide in an easy spot. You know, I don't want you to hide like the world championship Sasquatch, right? So once you've hidden, you're going to make a note. You're going to say your dog's name, Sparky, and then you're going to go boop, 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 boop. So that beeping is like reverse echolocation. The dog has to come find and look for where that beeping's coming from. When your dog successfully finds you, collar grab and give him a bunch of treats. So one, your dog is going to pay attention to where you are more and check in more regularly. And if you see, everything we talked about just now had to do with teaching the yes. It's not it's not getting upset when they don't come. It's rewarding the heck out of them when they do come.
And work on that. Probably that's the kind of thing that you're not going to teach in a minute.
No, but recall is probably, to me, one of the most important behaviors you could ever teach your dog. Just to turn on a dime and get to you really quick.
Yeah. Jane, give that a try. Work on that. And don't expect it to happen overnight. But even with a few weeks of training.
Dogs learn quickly.
Dogs will learn pretty quickly. Good luck. And thank you very much for calling. Dan in Middleton, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. This is a classic case of the grass being greener on the other side of the fence. We have an acre and a half fenced with a fence that has maybe a few weak points and a gate across our driveway. We also have an in-ground stubborn dog electric fence. Our dog, if the battery gets low or we forget to put the collar on it, finds a way out of the yard and roams the neighborhood. We'd like to somehow... We've tried to teach her the limits of the yard, but it doesn't seem to take.
One of the techniques I like to use in these cases is, and this is going back to like the electric fence, like the dog knows when the battery's low. That's intuitive, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So one of the things I like to do is make the grass greener in your yard. So how do you do that? Just trickling little treats where you want your dog to be. So if you think of your property like a dartboard, that middle bullseye is where you want your dog to sort of linger and hang out. So every now and again, if your dog is food motivated, you can go out there and just toss some yummy treats in the yard, and then they'll be scavenging there. I know a lot of places in my home in New York, when I lived there, all the hunters used to put the deer carcasses in this commercial land, and my little dog Charity would come back with like a deer leg or something and covered in bugs and stuff. But so she had fun leaving me, and she practiced that a lot. So I had to start putting her on leash and making sure she stayed close to the house, because she would just run off and go deer hunting herself. So by having treats in the area, in the vicinity where you want your pup to be and linger and hang out, that's where she'll start to hang out, because why would she go off to other places when there's this ATM spitting out 20s?
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking about somebody who called when Patricia McConnell and I used to do Calling All Pets, and somebody called, and they had the electrified underground fence and so forth, and they had the collar, and the collar would beep when the dog mm-hmm. got close. So the dog got shocked a couple times, and then the dog would walk up to until it started to beep, the warning beeps, and then it would sit down, and it would sit there until the beeps stopped. The battery had run out, and the dog would run over.
They're so smart. They're so smart. Right? But idle hands are the devil's tool. If you don't put them to work, they're going to put themselves to work, and they're going to figure stuff out. They love puzzles. That's hilarious.
The other one I remember is a woman who called and said, we had the dog, we had one of those fences, but we have these nice neighbors next door, and it was summertime, and we were over on their side having some whatever. But the dog was sitting, their dog was sitting looking, you know, longingly at them, and she said to her husband, go over and get the dog and bring it over. And so he knows to take off the collar. So he takes the collar off the dog. He shoves the collar in his pocket, and then he picks the dog up to carry it across.
Surprise.
Quite a surprise.
Surprise. That's amazing.
Oh, my goodness me. So there's a lot that can happen when you use that kind of.
Absolutely.
Man. Dan, thank you very much. Try some treats in your lawn.
Yeah.
And spread them out and let the dog know that that's a good place to be. Hannah in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, hello. I have a six-month-old puppy. And I've been putting a lot of energy into training her, and it's going well so far. She is allowed on the furniture at home. So when we go to other people's houses, like my grandparents, who are elderly and I don't want her jumping on them, mm-hmm. she feels like she can just jump right on them. So I guess I'm looking for some management.
Keep her off the couches of somebody else's home.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things, you know, for dogs, there's that idea of generalization, right? Like dogs are allowed to jump on their humans, and then they're like, don't jump on me when I'm wearing these pants. And it's like, you know, how are they supposed to differentiate pants or pants? So one of the things I discussed, and I was actually talking to, your lovely receptionist out there mm-hmm. about this.
Melissa,
where, you know, dogs can't discriminate at this young age. And when people get puppies, they sort of allow carte blanche, right? They get to do whatever they want. A lot of these adopted dogs come from the South. They've got stories that tug on our heartstrings and all that stuff. So what we just go, oh, you get all full freedom, sleep in bed with me, and you can do this, and you sort of give the dog everything they want. But then they're like, oh, you know what, you're getting big, or I'm going to need you to sleep in the crate. And the dog's like, what? You know where you can take your rules. You know, you can take them to the curb. So it's still not too late, because she's still your pup's still young. I would just say, like, no furniture for a while. And those are, like, what Patricia McConnell and Pat Miller call life rewards, right? Coming on the couch is a big deal. But when you're on the couch, there's rules. You have to lay quietly. You have to, right? We have to teach the yes parts of that behavior. Now, when you're when you go visit with family and friends, what you can teach is a game called chill out. And that's where you sit down, step on the leash, and you just wait for them to lay at your feet. Now, the fallout from this game is that your dog thinks that when they lay at people's feet, they get treats. So instead of jumping on the couch and being a nuisance, they're going to go and lay at people's feet. Remember, the behavior that's been reinforced happens more. So it's not about teaching them, because I do have a cue for my dogs where, you know, I was doing my domestic duties this week and I had to take all my couch cushions off and vacuum under the couch. And there's all the, you know.
Yeah, the usual
the
stuff.
The usual stuff. And my dogs were up on the couch and I said, off. But off is a tricky one because people tend to say off when the dog is doing something naughty. But here's the kicker. Dog is jumping up, like I said, impure thoughts about the roasted chicken on the counter, and you say, off, and the dog gets off. Shouldn't you give it a treat? It's too close to the bad behavior, right? That's the crux. So when a dog is doing something naughty, you can gently take them and move them off the furniture, off the whatever you want, but don't say anything. I use the cue off only for my dogs when they're on something they're allowed to be on. And then I'll say off is just like get off. Now, when it comes to this pup, it's like I said, it's not too late to teach. Is there a way that I can send her a video? I'd like to share this video with you. It's called Chill Out. If you type it in on YouTube or something, I'm sure a dozen will come up. But it's really a shaping game where they learn how to lay at your feet. And that'll prevent them from even wanting to go up on the couch. And then you can restrict it to specifically your home, your couch. Dog is allowed up.
Hannah, so it's called Chill Out?
Chill Out.
Chill Out. Go online, look at Chill Out and maybe something about keeping the dog off the couch or something. Yeah. Yeah, there you go, Hannah. Thank you very much for calling. Brenda in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Brenda.
Hey, hi, Larry. I have a question about my dog. He has horrendous bark. He is a border collie and a poodle. And anytime, like, somebody walks by our house, it's really obnoxious. And I don't know how we tried, like, bark collar. And I guess the bark collar works, but I don't know if there's something else I can do to, like, kind of hinder the barking.
Yeah, and, you know, again, with the bark collar, you're suppressing that behavior. The dog, what's your dog's name?
Barnaby.
Barnaby. I like that.
Barnaby.
Yeah. So Barnaby, he's you know, being a dog. And now you said border collie mix, right?
Yeah.
What's the border collie's job? Manage space, right? They manage space. I didn't authorize this woman to walk past the house. And who said she could walk over there? And who's this dog, right? And he gets all worked up and he's barking at the window. So the technique I like to teach people around window barking is I have a cue. Now, be careful, because most of the time when a dog is barking out the window, we get very gruff and we go, hey, knock it off, quiet. And the dog goes, I know, me too. We're barking at this thing, right? And everybody's barking out the window. So instead, we want to change how we say it. Now, the follow-up on this is very important. So Barnaby starts barking at the window, and then we go, thank you. Because you know what? You want your dog to bark a little bit. It's okay for them to bark and alert. I think it's normal behavior. But it's just the overdoing it. Now, so you say, thank you. If Barnaby so much as burps or barks again after that, he's getting a timeout. You're going to take him by the collar, gently walk him into a room, and shut the door for about a minute. And then lather, rinse, repeat. If you say thank you and he gets quiet and looks at you because you're saying it with a nice upward inflection, he's more likely to look at you and come like, oh, I'm being good. I could do this. So he comes over. Then you can give him some treats for being quiet. But if he goes right back to the window to bark, he gets his little timeout. And it's about due diligence here. Do your work. And then he'll start to realize that thank you means please be quiet.
Yeah.
Sounds
like she's going to have plenty of opportunities.
If she has a corner lot, you've got nothing but time. There was the other part to this too, in terms of the window barking, is management. So imagine a dog, right? You have a dog, and the dog is home all day, and you know, and people often think I practice feng shui because I'm like, all right, so your couch is up against the big bay window. They're like, how did you know? I'm like, that's where the dog perches and is barking at the whole kingdom. So when this dog is barking and home alone, nobody's there to tell them otherwise. But that dog is being reinforced, not by treats, but by the fact that they went away. UPS yeah. guy comes up, beeps the package, walks away, gets in his truck. Dog's barking the whole entire time. And the dog says, Aaron, stay out. Nobody gave him a treat, but he made the scary UPS man go away. So that's a reward. So they could be rehearsing the behavior without you even being there and being rewarded for it.
So close the curtain would be...
Close the curtain. They make those little frosted decals you can put on the glass. Just, just not giving the dog access to that room. Right? To where they can rehearse. And some dogs are stinkers. They start in one room. They bark at that window. Then they come to the next window because they know the person's slowly walking in front of the house. And they do that in the backyard. If they have a fence, they'll go from one side of the house to the other to bark and continue to bark and shoo that person away.
Brenda, give that a shot. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. George Malara, our guest today, professional dog trainer. Great to have him with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your dog today, or maybe your son or daughter's dog, or the grandparents' dog, or the dog down the street with our guest, George Malara, professional dog trainer. It's great to have him with us. Vivian in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I'm so glad you mentioned rescue dogs, and I thank every foster
yes.
who's ever taken one in. But I have a Kentuckian and a Texan.
Right on.
My Kentucky dog, she's 14. She's had all teeth removed due to resorption.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying, I don't know if it's even realistic, but I'm trying to train her to keep her tongue in her mouth, which is very difficult without teeth.
Yep.
I've been using squeezy teeth.
Yeah, the teeth is what keeps the tongue in your mouth.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, that's going to be... Now, do you notice, like, her tongue really, like, lolling out and drying out?
Yeah, I'm concerned, and coconut oil was recommended, but I think maybe I can help it a little bit if the training.
Mm. You know... This is more of a physiological issue than it is a training issue, because it's normal for a dog to keep their tongue in their mouth, throughout the day. This is because she doesn't have any teeth, the tongue is just going to slip out, especially when she's sleeping. But it's just going to, it's going to slide out. I personally can't think of a way to make the tongue stay in, and it might also be strenuous to keep your tongue in a specific spot. In humans, they talk about snoring, right? You want to keep mm-hmm. the tongue forward, like behind the front teeth. That's hard to do. It's really mm-hmm. hard to do even during the day when I'm awake. I would probably look at this more of a management thing, and maybe the training that can be done is desensitizing her to a spray bottle, where you can get mix a little bit of low sodium chicken or beef broth with some water in a spray bottle, and then just sort of spray her tongue just to keep it moist. And then she'll want to lap it up and keep her tongue in her mouth. But I think overall, based on her age and her ability, I think, her tongue wants to be free.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember if this has ever come up with a vet. If there is any kind of contraption that can be used, but I don't know of any.
No, any of my older dogs that had even my little Suka, she's got a couple front teeth, and when she sleeps, it sneaks out, her little tongue sneaks out, and I just stuff it back in.
Yeah, but I do like the spray bottle idea. That's with chicken
broth, low sodium chicken broth, beef broth. And what you would do is you would just like, you know, just squirt it so that there's some on the tip, let her lick it off, and then, you know, spray some on your hand, let her lick it off your hand, and then start spraying it in her mouth and see if she'll like lick it as you like half pull the trigger, and then the liquid will come out, and then she can start licking it until you're able to just do a gentle little spray on her tongue just to keep it moist.
Yeah. Vivian, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. David in Lake Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, David.
Hey, David.
Hi. Hey, I love this show. I'm actually from Iowa, but I'm visiting for Christmas in Lake Tomahawk. So I have three Siberian Huskies. Two of them are pretty normal. One of them is skittish. He will not walk on a hardwood floor, a ceramic floor, a linoleum floor, but he will walk on concrete.
Uh-huh. More grip.
And I don't know. He's been that way since he was a pup.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when dogs are puppies, it's when we want to expose them to all these different surfaces. But this can be a physiological issue, meaning like his so making sure. What's your pup's name, David?
Roan.
Roan.
Like in Roan, Alaska.
Oh, very nice. Rome. Yeah, Rome, Alaska. So one is making sure that their nails are clipped, like properly clipped, so that they're short enough so that they're not making contact with the ground, because that can cause for slipperiness. With huskies, I mean, they have that extra fur in between their pads. And groomers have like these really fine little clippers that they can get in between there and really help trim up the hair to make them less slippery. And then the other one is moisturizing their pads. Sometimes dogs' pads, if you touch them, they can be pretty dry. Keeping them moist and pliable. Think about, you know, if your hands are dry and you're trying to turn the page in a book, what do? You lick your finger and turn the page. So a little bit of moisture, talk to your vet about whatever kind of cream you can use on their feet. But just a little bit of moisturization. And then when it comes to the training part of this, so making sure that their feet have, you know, we want them to have like sticky little gecko feet. Then when we talk about the training part, I would probably set up runners in your house, and then little by little start putting the runners farther apart, so they have to walk on the hardwood floor. And you could even try throwing like kibble or treats on the hardwood floor, seeing if they'll slowly start exploring these little areas where there's the slippery risk factor, but with the proper nail trims, the hair trimmed from their paws, and the moisturizer might give them that extra little grip to help them feel more secure. And then Rome will start venturing out into these different floors and areas. How old is Rome?
It's Roan with an N.
Oh, Roan.
He's 11.
He's 11. Yeah, and you know, we oftentimes forget our dogs getting older. So like, there might be a little bit of uneasiness in their hips and their knees and elbows. So you know, providing them with like good grip support and making sure that they have these little runners, so that, you know, taking a tumble might have caused discomfort and pain, and now he's just like, oh, these slippery floors are going to be the death of me.
Yeah. Dave, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. I like, as always, I like George's advice on this. Robin in St. Paul, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I am curious about, George, how you feel about crate training with an eight-week-old puppy. How do you do it? When do you start it? How long do you tolerate them, you know, whining and crying and not liking being in a crate?
Yeah, so crate training is so super important. But 8 weeks might be a smidge young in respect to how much time you leave them alone. So how we start to just, what you want to do is make the crate a really great place. And I love this call. Crates are very, very dear to me. A lot of people, remember that it's only a cage if you use it like one.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're using it as a tool, it can be very, very valuable. Crates can keep dogs safe. Puppies are, you know, they're looking to kill themselves, like biting wires and eating stuff and, you know, getting into all sorts of nonsense, where, you know, having them in a crate or some sort of confinement can be really, really helpful. Now, when we get to the point of helping them feel better in their crate or exercise pen, I like X pens for puppies, and I'll actually put, do you know what an X pen is?
No.
Imagine a really pretty like Japanese partition where it folds on itself like an accordion.
Okay.
And then it connects to itself. So you can make like a little corral, a little pen.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up exercise pen online, you'll be overwhelmed. And then in that exercise pen, I have a little crate. So depending, and the crate should be dependent on the size of the puppy. So what I do is make sure that all good things happen in that crate or in that confinement, right? And the idea of puppies, and I do like a little test where I'm just like, all right, I'm going to wait 5 minutes and see when you start to cry. Now, I'm a dirty hippie. When it cries, you pick it up, right? You don't want them to, you don't want them to be struggling, because 8 weeks, they're still young enough where they might have a little bit of panic in their tone when they're being left alone, because they just came from being with their litter mates or mom or whoever, and then now they're alone. So it can be a little bit scary for puppies. So we want to be gentle with their little spirits. So when we put them in their kennel pen, make sure they have something yummy, right? You can stuff a Kong with a little bit of frozen peanut butter. You can leave them with their like nice Chewies, Bully Sticks, rawhide. They make these rawhides that are not rawhides, which I like. They're called Franklies, and then there's another one called No Hide. But you give them all the good stuff happens in there. And at times what I'll do is one of the games I play with dogs, and this is a great one. You get a Kong and you run a rope through it. On the bigger opening side of the Kong, you tie a couple knots and then you pull the rope through. So you have like a Kong on a rope. Then you stuff it with all the yummy stuff, spray cheese, peanut butter, yogurt, whatever you want to load it up with. And then you tie it to the back of the crate and you leave the crate door open. If you want it, you got to go eat it in there. And this is like the old infomercial, you know, set it and forget it, right? You just set this up in the crate, and your puppy is going to want to be in the crate. So you're rewarding for location. You're rewarding for duration. You're rewarding for position. Dogs will tend to lie down when they're eating their Kongs. So you're getting all this behavior for just tying the Kong in the crate. And the reason we tie it is so that they can't dine and dash, right? They don't just grab it and go eat it somewhere else. No, you can have this, but you have to have it in your crate. And by then, there's so many wonderful things happening in and around the crate that they're like, this is my safe spot. If they steal the TV remote, I want them to go to their crate with it. That's their little bat cave.
So, and with crates, do you put a towel or a blanket or anything on the...
It depends on the dog.
Yeah.
Really, there's some dogs that will just shred a towel. And the scary thing is about ingestion, right? I worry about dogs eating it. Some people make the suggestion of putting the towel over the crate to make it more quiet and den-like. But then you have the dogs that pull the towels through the crate. So you have to sort of dip your toe in the water and feel out, like, what kind of puppy you have and really see what the best way of getting them, you know, the best setup for each dog. And some puppies will pee on the blankets and then scoot it out of the way. For puppies that are that small, they make crates that grow with your puppy. So there's a partition inside. Mm-hmm. And then as the puppy gets bigger, the partition can be scooted further back. So the crate grows with the puppy. Because with little dogs or puppies, sometimes they have so much space in there that they're like, oh, I got to go potty. I'm going to go in the corner over there. And it's far enough away where it's not going to bother them.
I was wondering about the potty business with an 8-week-old. They got to go to the potty pretty often.
And you don't want
them in the crate too long.
Right. And it's all about timetables and just making sure, like, you know, the mantra for puppy training is, for house training is, when in doubt, take them out. By the time you start humming and hawing and going like, I think you drank some water earlier. Yeah, they peed somewhere. Just get them outside. Last thing about the crate I wanted to mention was, be very careful with getting them in the crate to start. People will throw some treats and the puppy starts going in and they shut the door very harshly, surprise, and then the puppy's like, well, never trusting you again.
Yeah.
So take your time.
Leave the door open.
Yep.
There you go, Robin. Thank you so much. George Malara will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with George. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your dog's behavior on the program today, just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show, it's a big day tomorrow because at noon Santa Claus comes and Elf Jingle, and they are going to take calls from all the young people. So it's a young people's call day. And to tell Santa what they want for Christmas.
I always like watching them on NORAD. They can follow the sled.
Well, the sled lands on the top of Radio Hall, of Vilas Hall, and we got a flat roof so they can do it. And
what do you charge them to park up there? Nothing. Well, it's on the house.
It's on the house. Oh.
I had to. Sorry.
Anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you have children or you have grandchildren visiting or maybe the friends from Oklahoma are in town with their kids, have them call tomorrow at noon and talk to Santa and tell Santa what they want for Christmas.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
Right now, though, we're talking your pet's behavior, and Sheila in Clinton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Hi. Hello. I adopted a dog on Saturday. It was kind of an emergency situation. The owner is dying, and they needed a place. And I said I would do it. Mm-hmm. And she's 8-year-old Doberman. The family stipulated that she can't be in a kennel. And I'm assuming from what I see, she can't be in a crate. When I got there, she didn't want anybody to touch her, approaching her from the front. And we did get a lead on. I put her in the car. We got here and I took her outside, did all of that. And, I took the lead off when I got in the house, and she didn't want anything to do with me. I couldn't bribe her. There was no food that she would take. I found an old soft chew that she was willing to do. I got the lead back on her, and she got on the bed, you know, which was fine. I invited her there, but she would lay there, seem to go to sleep, and then jump up as if there was an electrical shock on her. And she'd jump off the bed. This went on and off all night long. And anytime I had the TV on, if I turned the TV off, same thing, freak out. And at 3:30 in the morning, I thought, I can't do this anymore. You're going to decide what you're going to do. And I fell asleep for a couple hours. I got up. She was laying on a dog bed I had. And she didn't do any baths, and she didn't do anything. She didn't urinate anywhere. She didn't chew anything up. And I was able to get her outside and do all of that. But there's some kind of compulsion, it looks like to me, because it's you can't interrupt it. And it's almost...
So the one thing I want to
seizure-like.
Yeah, the one thing I want to mention about this is it also has to do with the time of year. When I go to my clients' homes and when it's really dry, this dry air, cold dry air is static. So there's so many times where like I'm sitting around on the couch and I go to like just pet the dog or give the dog a treat and zap, I zap them with, you know, my static electricity, and sometimes they'll jump. If you don't know this dog's complete history or where this dog came from, this is a big, big change for her. And thank you so much for opening your heart and your home to this wonderful dog.
And the dog probably knows that its owner is
very for sure. For sure. You know, like, and absolutely, Larry, like dogs aren't dumb. Like, she knows that her owner is sick and maybe passed, or, you know, we have to sort of just meet her with love, kindness, compassion, and empathy. So just giving her like this sort of letting her be in your home. If the crate or you need to sort of confine her a little bit more, baby gates work really great. And the ones that are with pressure, so like there's ones that sort of like, I can't describe it.
Accordion.
Yeah, accordion, and they sort of put pressure on the edge of the door. You can actually stack two on top of each other if she's a flight risk, if she wants to jump out. I would absolutely be concerned about her being a flight risk outside. So making sure that you have her tags on, good sturdy collar, maybe even using two leashes on a harness and her collar just for safety and backup. Decompression. She's going through a lot. It sounds like you're going through a lot too, taking this on. But just giving her that time and just giving her that time just to sort of decompress and just find her legs under her. This might take a few days, a couple weeks. The fact that you're able to get her outside to go potty is great. And she's eating a little bit. Use whatever food is going to get the job done. So if you know that she's on a specific type of kibble, you find the wet food that's comparable to that, except it's wet food. So if she's on a chicken and rice formula food, you find a wet chicken food that you can use to feed her too. Wet food is just so much more palatable for dogs. And just sort of keeping the house quiet, keeping it comfortable. And what I would say too, just as a little test, because that behavior of like on off TV, the clicking, there could be some sound sensitivity. But I would just like, if you're able to touch and pet her, do it with a dryer sheet. Just to sort of break up the static and maybe just like rub the dryer sheet on the sheets of the bed, just to sort of break up any static electricity. I'd be curious to know if that's part of the issue, because as we move around in bed, you're building up this static charge, and the first thing she touches with her wet little nose, she's going to get a big, you know, Nikola Tesla coil on her nose.
So kindness
and I would also reach out to a veterinarian and getting her on some sort of not a sedative. We want something that's going to help her feel better. So like possibly like a trazodone, a gabapentin, something that's just going to just really like it's like a Xanax, just to sort of just take the edge off, just so that she can recoup some of her feelings. And then talking longer term, talking about something that's like an SSRI, like a proper Prozac or something, if she does have these issues, because she's 11, and we have to also honor like what she would be able to learn in that short amount of time.
Yeah. Good luck, Sheila.
Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you very much for what you're doing and for calling today. Let's turn to Barbara in Milwaukee. Barbara, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi,
Barbara.
I have lived with dogs my whole life. I work outside, and a property I work at has a 14-year-old lab. She's lovely and pretty well-mannered, not overly trained, but she does have one habit. There's two people in the family she really likes, and when they visit, she barks her head off. When I come there, she barks her head off. And I am a dog person, but the dogs that we had, we would typically have that, you know, if they wanted attention, they had to behave first, whether it was sitting first and then, you know, play or whatever. And there was also an enough cue. She's 14 years old. She's not my dog. What? And the owner then just gets tired of her barking and takes her inside. I'd love to have her be able to stay out in the yard while I'm working.
She barks until she gets attention.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it sounds like this has been working for her for 14 years.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the other thing, you know, like imagine practicing anything for 14 years, you'd be a master.
Yeah.
Right. So the best you can do here is management. So something you could do is like stuff a Kong and then freeze it so that she has something to lick and work on. She's 14, so I don't know if she has any dental issues, so she might not be good at like chomping on stuff. So make whatever you're going to give her like lickable. A little bit of spray cheese, a little bit of wet dog food, you know, just anything that's going to be palatable for her. Stuff the Kong, freeze it, and then have it with you in the yard and keep it close to you so that she's got to be like working on something while you're working on whatever you're working on. It's just about giving her an alternative behavior where she's not just barking at you for the sake of barking. And at 14, being a Cavalier, like there might be some hearing loss. She might not hear herself barking. There's a lot of different things that could be going on. But the idea that she's been doing this for a minute is probably going against what you want to have accomplished.
I do like that idea because that gets her doing something else.
Right.
Yeah.
And if she's food motivated, again, like, even, you know, people buy these snuffle mats. Have you seen those? Like, mm-hmm. it's like I call them like little, like Rasta little long haired things, and you put kibble in it in the house. Outside, I just leave a patch of grass extra long. I do it outside. My dogs love it. They really go bonkers for it. So even just scattering food, just tapping into that like scavenging mode, because dogs love to look for food. Give her something to do. Show her what is yes.
Barbara, good luck. Thank you. Linda in Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great, good, thank appreciate you. The call.
Well, thank you. Thank you for answering questions. I have a year-and-a-half-old hound whippet mix.
Wow.
Who has a lot of energy. I've had her since last January. And when we go to the dog park, this particular dog park has a bench right next to the fence from the large to the small dog park.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be standing somewhere further away, and my dog occasionally runs to the bench, jumps on top of the bench, to the top of the fence, down to the bench into the next park. And I'm afraid she's going to hurt herself and slip or something when it's snowing or raining.
Yeah.
And I've tried to say, don't do this, but she'll run over at will when she sees something interesting on that side and just jump her little self on over.
We have, I tend to frequent a dog park over here in Madison. Of course, I'm blanking on it. The one over by Farmers Road. And there's a picnic table right near the smaller dog park. And I see dogs doing that all the time. The grass is greener, right? So is that bench like bolted to the ground, or can you move it?
Yeah. Yep, they're bolted on the large side and the small side right in between the fence.
Gotcha.
Where she can do that.
So if you can predict that she's going to go for it, right, then what I would do is like, As you're walking around the dog park, what I would do is I would put her on leash before you get to that bench, and then walk her past it, because that's just, again, management. We're not allowing her to rehearse the behavior of making that jump into the other park. And I'm guessing you're not worried about her playing with the little dogs, but it's just like the action of making that leap is a little,
that's the problem,
Evel Knievel dangerous. Putting her on leash and walking her past it, and then letting her off leash once you're past it and she's less tempted to go back and get it. And I would feed her treats as you're passing that bench. The other and again, just management. And even if, like, which dog park do you go to?
It's in Racine.
Oh, Racine.
I
won't know.
It's Corey.
Okay.
It's Corey in Racine. And she's about 30 pounds. It's right at the entrance, but we go in and we play further down or in the middle, and she's really an energetic maniac of a whippet mix.
Mm-hmm.
And so it never fails that randomly she runs back and forth trying to play with everyone and just jumping right on over there to see who else is on that side.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the other thing you can do if you wanted to take it to, like, a little bit more extreme is if she does jump over, you go hunt her down like the lowly dog she is, and you put her on leash, and you go sit in the car for 20 minutes. Right? There has to be a consequence to her action. And, again, we don't want to punish her. Like, we don't want to, you know, do anything mean to her. But just, like, saying, well, you jumped into the – that's not allowed. If you want the play to continue, you don't do that. We're going to go sit in the car for a few minutes, and then – you bring her back in. And remember that the idea with punishment is that you always want to make sure that you put your dog back in the same situation. We oftentimes will manage a dog's environment so they can't give us another answer. And that's how you test the behavior. You have to be a little bit of a scientist and go, here's my theory and I have to test it. I have to put you in practice. Like, are you going to go for it? If you do, that means I have to do more work. If you don't, I reward you and that means the training's working.
Makes good sense. Linda, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Kat in Waterloo, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Kat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have about a 2.5-year-old lab husky retriever mix, and he's starting to get anxiety in the car, pants a lot, can't seem to settle, and for a really long time he used to be fine, he would lay down, but we got caught in a really bad rainstorm this past summer, and I think the noise might have messed with him, but I just am trying to figure out a way to make him a little bit more calmer in the car, because he just pants all the time, and he's obviously, like, uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whenever we have to go back and do this type of, like, exposure therapy, is everything has to happen just, like, in tiny, tiny little bite-sized moments. So I would load him up in the car, and the moment he gets in the car, give him some treats, and then have him jump out of the car. Whenever we're dealing with something, like, it's the idea of being in the car, but he has to realize that, like, okay, good things are happening in the car. But what we tend to do is we tend to sort of we sort of saturate the dog, and it becomes too much. We want them wanting more. So what we do is we load them in the car, give them a, you know, a couple of really yummy treats, maybe just start the car, shut it off, jump out of the car, get out of the car. And then later, you know, half hour, 45 minutes, hour later, do it again. Except this time, bring a book and sit there for maybe 3 to 5 minutes, read a couple pages, and then get out of the car. And while he's in the back, you can give him a chewy, a bully stick, a Kong, something to work on. But we want to interrupt it almost to the point where leaving the car is a punishment. Right. Mm-hmm. So you give him the yummy Kong. It's like, okay, let's go inside, you know, and just take it away from him. He's like, no, let's stay for a little longer. We always want him wanting more. So, you know, right when you think you should stop training, you should have stopped 5 minutes earlier. and then just continue on that path. Less is more. And when you're training, it's quality over quantity. A lot of people want to saturate and, like, I got to spend time in the car, and the dog has time to work themselves into a lather and get upset, as opposed to working in really short stints. The dog doesn't have time to work themselves in the lather because they're getting some treats. They're like, oh yeah, the car's not so bad. I can deal with this. And definitely check the weather before going out with him in the car, because, you know, rain. And if it rains, he could get scared.
Yeah. All right, Kat, thank you very much, and good luck. Nancy in Ridgeland, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Larry. I have one comment about the lady in Racine. Maybe the municipality could extend that fence a little higher right by the bench, not for her dog, but for some other more aggressive dog that might have a worse outcome. That's all to itself.
That's great thinking.
What I called about was... now that it's the season where we're plugging lots of things in, there's apparently an issue with smart outlets and smart switches and that kind of stuff, and they have caused some really serious effect only in some dogs, and veterinarians have been kind of, you know, a dog will come in drooling, not able to eat, pacing, having lots of very strange behaviors, and there's nothing physically wrong with the dog, but something in those electronic gizmos is setting them off. And when they turn them off, the dog goes back to normal within an hour or two.
Yep,
so I just thought I'd mention that in case somebody's seeing something undiagnosed.
There's sub frequencies that only the dogs are picking up on, and it just causes for like fear, anxiety, and just really abnormal behavior. I'm surprised you know that, because not a lot of people do. It's one of the things that I look at, like, when I go into homes, and they can also happen with the smart light bulbs, any of those smart things. They have like a little click, a frequency that the dogs hear, and it can really stress them out.
Excellent points, Nancy. Thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy.
Amy in Milwaukee asked, if you're training a dog with food so much, won't it gain weight? How many training treats are food is too much? And how do you provide regular meals if you're feeding so much while training?
So one of the things about treats, and this is a question that comes up a lot, you know, people say, like, well, how many treats is too much? Well, you have to look at each behavior that you're training. As they start to get better at the behavior, you're not going to be paying as much as you did in the beginning when the behavior was, like, in conception. And let's say you're working on, say, 4 or 5 different behaviors: sit, down, stay, and come. So when you're working with these behaviors, number one is when I train my dogs, I'm using a very high quality dog treat. So I'm using chicken hearts. I'm using Happy Howies, which is like all organ meat. I'm using all these high quality foods. So I don't feel bad that my dog is eating quote unquote treats because they're really healthy. They're not eating snossages and bacon strips and, you know, the lesser quality McDonald's type treats. So when at the end of the day, if my dog Dolly and I have done a bunch of training sessions, I would say, at the breakfast, she always gets the same amount throughout the day. She's getting all these extra treats and working with me, and she's my demo dog and whatnot. At the end of the day, I ask myself, I'm like, all right, how much did you eat today? You know what? Today you ate like a Vietnamese potbelly pig. I'm only going to give you a scant scoop.
Yeah. Or just give them less.
Or just give them a little less. And I don't feel bad because the treats that they're getting are super high quality and healthy for them. My dogs are healthy.
Yeah.
Lean, beautiful.
Well, on the kind of relating to this, Jen and Verona emailed to say they found a dog training to be more effective when the dog's hungry. This is helpful, seriously helpful for working on recall. Giving your dog only a third of its usual breakfast and then walking at 10:30 means you're going to have more success.
And I like that they were clear about, so some people, people say hunger makes the best sauce, but I don't do well when I'm hangry.
No.
I am not thinking clearly. I feel like one of those, stuck on a deserted island and Larry starts to look like a hot dog. So I love the fact that we are feeding some of their meal. That's wonderful because, yeah, it makes them a little more peckish and a little bit more likely to motivate. But I would never do it on an empty stomach. My dogs, I feed them before I train so that they are, it's one less distraction for them to be able to think and learn when they're not hungry.
Well, yeah. So the dog gets a third.
Love it.
Yeah. And then the treats cover the rest.
Hunger makes the best sauce.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, boy, we've covered a lot here today, George.
We did. We did good work, Larry.
Any final comment for those folks who are welcoming all the neighbors or their family members tomorrow?
Remember that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Stuff all your stuffable toys with yummy things. Make sure you pop over to your local pet store and pick up any chewies or rawhides or things that can be like a coloring book for a dog. Having a quiet room with a sign on it saying like dog is resting right now. Before guests and visitors show up, make sure you take them for a big old walk. Make sure they're good and tired physically, tired mentally. And you can jump on YouTube and just train whatever. Just train a new little trick or something. That's going to get them mentally tired. And then making sure that, you monitor what's out. ASPCA has a list of foods that are toxic for dogs. So making sure that nobody's feeding your pup anything that's going to give them a tummy ache or make them sick. And happy holidays and enjoy your dogs.
George, happy holidays to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Larry. Love being here.
Yeah, we'll look forward to your next visit.
All right.
Appreciate it very much. George Malara, our guest today, a professional dog trainer. He's trained dogs for more than 20 years. He is owner of Divine Canine in Madison, and he also volunteers his time and skill with other not-for-profit organizations and rescue groups and does a wonderful job. It's great to have him, and we will have him back. Coming up, Wisconsin has a very unique highway maintenance system. I bet there's some things you didn't know about relating to it, and we're going to learn a whole lot more coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. We're going to turn our attention to highway maintenance systems here in our state. For over 100 years, we've had a very unique system. Counties are responsible for maintaining their local roadways, also the state highways and the interstates within their counties. So Wisconsin's 72 counties maintain, I think it's something like almost 20,000 miles of county trunk highway system and almost 12,000 miles of state trunk highway systems, as well as the interstates. And we're going to be talking about this today with our guest, how our winter roads are plowed and salted statewide, some issues relating to that. Robbie Krejci is our guest. Robbie is the Highway Commissioner for St. Croix County and President of the Wisconsin County Highway Association. So what do you want to know about how snowplow drivers respond to storms? How well are the county and state highways you drive maintained? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Robbie Krejci, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be on here today and talk to you about this very interesting topic and pertinent this time of year.
Very pertinent. And you're president of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, and it's a nonprofit. What does it do?
We are the group of counties that often advocate for safety, whether it's highway-related or topics in and around our transportation system that make Wisconsin vibrant. So we are the advocates on the county side.
And you're the County Highway Commissioner for St. Croix County. What does that job entail in West Central St. Croix County?
Well, it's busy. We're a growing county. We are the first county in from Minneapolis. So we are, you know, what I would say my role is to manage the transportation system within St. Croix. And we're meeting the needs of both our businesses and our residents within the county.
Talk about what goes on throughout Wisconsin. We got local county highway departments maintaining the state highways. How does this work?
We are unique in Wisconsin. We're one of the only. The state of Michigan has done a few pilots now where they're looking at our system and maybe trying to copy it. But we're unique in that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation contracts with each county in Wisconsin to do maintenance. It's routine maintenance on the state highway and interstate system within those county boundaries.
And it's been going on for 100 years.
Yeah, over 100 years, I believe. So it's great. We know the system. We know the weak points in the system, and we're poised and ready to provide service. We also provide that duplication in which we're already maintaining our county system. And in some cases, we partner with our other locals, the cities and villages and towns within our county. So we're often best suited to provide that service locally.
Good question from Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin. Vern, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so we're out here in County Road G, okay? And it's in eastern Eau Claire County. Some of the roads are good ice. I have four stars and two caps on. So I slipped and fell. So how do you get them to sand and salt? You call the school, you call the post office, and they call the county highway department. And guess what? They're going to sand and salt the road. Otherwise, they wouldn't.
Well, okay, so Vern's in a situation where there was a little slippery on his road, so he calls the, gets a hold of the county, and the county is sending somebody to salt or sand his road. Is that something that often happens?
Those calls happen every day, especially in our active winter conditions like we've had in our area here locally. Our workplace is not too far from Boyd, so we've had an active winter so far this year, and that's pretty typical where we are outperforming that routine maintenance, but often we have to go back and hit those spots. You know, your average plow operator is taking care of approximately 50 miles of road. So it may take a significant amount of time, especially if we have some pretty adverse conditions for that operator to make it all the way around their section or route. So we often respond and we take calls and try to target specific areas. A lot of our operators have been on their section and beat for many years, so they're often one step ahead. They know the curve that always gets icy because it's shaded. They know the hill that gets slippery. So those operators provide tremendous service in some really difficult conditions.
You know, that makes sense to me as you were saying that. I was thinking, well, maybe this is why we do county by county. If you're using the same men and women operating within a particular county, they get to know those kinds of things that you're talking about, those kinds of potential issues.
I can share a unique story there. There was a former operator in our department that, depending on the day of the week, and what I mean by that is if school was in session or not, he would do his route differently based on where the priority was for that day. And that comes with experience and operating on that route for a long period of time, knowing where he needs, where he or she needs to get first and where are the priorities, even based on the day. So it's a great opportunity for us to provide that good service.
Yeah, that's a great system. You do other kinds of maintenance work as well, do you not? You know, maybe potholes or things like that?
Yes, we do all the routine maintenance on the state system as well. And when I say routine maintenance, it's from filling potholes to filling the cracks and doing those other system-wide maintenance things that don't involve reconstruction on, you know, reconstruction or repaving on the state system. Those are done by our contracting partners, but we do all the routine stuff. So it is not uncommon to see us out mowing the ditch on a state highway or filling a pothole on the interstate. Those are roles we fill for the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. John in Baronet has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Great show. I was just listening to your guest there from St. Croix County, and I live in Barron County right next door. And I work in Turtle Lake and live in Baronet. It's about a 19-mile trip. And the last snowstorm we had, which was a beauty, I don't know what we got, 6-8 inches of snow or something, all the way from Turtle Lake to Baronet, about 19 miles, there was never a sign that a plow truck had been up and down that highway. I drive a little Ford Focus, and I was literally scraping the belly. I couldn't get up to speed because the belly of the car was scraping the snow all the way home. So,
yeah, point. Well, what do you think, Robbie?
Well, and it depends. So that's a unique comment because whether you're driving on, it's important to understand the distinctions. So the towns or cities and villages have jurisdiction over their roads. So they make a decision of when and how they're going to plow. The county highways are the same for the counties in the state. They really dictate how they want us to do maintenance. A great example, I-94, the main thoroughfare, high traffic. We're going to have 24 hours of service. If it's snowing or there's inclement weather or there's any reason that for us to be out there, we're going to be out there. As you drop down in traffic volume, and what I mean by that, the less cars per day, the state looks, and so do the locals, look and say, well, we're going to provide service from, say, 10 p.m., or excuse me, from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. We're going to get you to work in the morning. We're going to get you safely home at night. And then just for pure level of service, we need to let our operators rest. They're going to rest from, say, 10 p.m. to 3:30 a.m., and then we're going to be back out on the road the next day trying to get you to work again. So depending on where you're driving and what road you're driving on, you might see a variance in the level of service. So if you start out on your town road and it hasn't been plowed, you get to the county road, which is starts to carry more traffic. We may have been out at 2 a.m. and already have plowed it, and you get to the interstate, and it's going to be bare. And that's just understanding the level of service on those different roads.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I was just thinking of a different situation, but City of Madison now, the last big snowfall, the main thoroughfares in the city were, that's where they concentrated because there was a lot of snow coming a lot of times, and people were told, well, look, your street's probably not going to get plowed, because we need to keep the main thoroughfares open. And I guess it's kind of the same way, in a way, with what you guys are doing out in the counties.
Exactly. And I think that's a great reference where some of those lower volume residential streets lose a little priority. I'll give you a great example. On a normal snowstorm, we'll put 5 trucks on our portion of I-94 in St. Croix County. We've had snowstorms where we've had up to 12 trucks out there trying to keep the interstate open. Well, that pulls resources from other highways that just to keep the main open was our priority so traffic could flow through. It's always difficult, but it's establishing priorities, and we try to base that on traffic safety, where the most volume of traffic is moving. And yes, some of those residential streets once in a while especially in your cities and villages, can get done last. And unfortunately, someone has to be plowed first and someone has to be plowed last.
Oh, boy. Well, I tell you what, we're talking today with Robbie Krejci, who is the St. Croix County Highway Commissioner and president of the Wisconsin County Highway Association. Question about what's going on maybe in your county, or maybe you just have a general question about how the system works. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about Christmas movies with film critic Jameson Rabbit. And then at noon, Santa Claus and Elf Jingle make their annual visit to the Larry Mueller Show. And Santa, we take calls from youngsters from all over, in and out of the state. We've had many calls from even outside the state. But if you have a child or some grandchildren visiting, or just maybe some friends visiting with kids, have them call the show tomorrow afternoon and tell Santa what they want for Christmas. This show is always a lot of fun for me. I think we've been doing it 30 years or so, and it's Santa's and Elf Jingle are really good at it. and it's always a lot of fun. But right now, we're taking your questions and comments about our state, Wisconsin County Highway Association Commissioner and President Robbie Krejci with us today. And we'll turn to Perry in Oconto. Perry, what's on your mind?
Yes. Is there any training that the operators or the supervisors go through as how much salt do they actually need to put down? I know that Larry had a lady biologist on last year talking about putting down salt and how it gets into the waterways and the lakes and streams. And there was a fellow from Eau Claire that did very similar to what you did. And he had mentioned how little salt is actually needed. In Oconto, we usually have our roads salted so it looks like snow's still on there.
In other words, a lot of salt. This whole question of salt is an interesting one, Robbie. Comment on what goes into figuring out this whole system.
And we work very hard to reduce the amount of salt we use on the roadways. This has been something, as a state, we've taken very serious. The counties do a lot in training together. We don't try to recreate the wheel, and we try to learn from one another. We typically, in the past, if you looked at WSDOT guidance, what they would say is they would like to see 300 pounds per lane mile of highway as a maximum consumption of salt. But what I'll tell you is it really depends on the storm. And what we have really worked hard at is introducing new techniques across the state. And there's been counties across the state, and I always like to call out a couple in particular. Jefferson County, Wisconsin has really been on the leading edge of this as well, of brine utilization. And brine is a fancy word for salt water. We're mixing 2.2 pounds of salt per gallon of water. And what we found is with that chemical reaction, suspending it in brine, we're getting much more of that to stay on the road. If you're just spreading dry salt, you'll lose only about 40% of that stays on the road if you're going 30 miles an hour as the plow moves along the road. So we've really focused our energy on getting that material to where it needs to be and keeping it where it is. When I started 25 years ago, we could buy a ton of salt for $30. The county I work with, it's over 100 at this point. So it's something we have devoted a lot of effort and resources into retooling how we do things. And our operators exercise great judgment. But every storm is a little different. Is it windy? Is the temperature below zero? Because what I can tell you, if it's below zero, we can put down salt, a lot of salt, and its effectiveness is minimized by the cold. So each storm is different. We don't have a set playbook across all 72 counties because we have to deal with that storm that's happening in our specific area.
Yeah, yeah. It's and there's some other things that have been tried. I know beet juice, for example. Some counties were experimenting with that and some other things as well.
And that's what's been happening. The county just north of us in Polk originally worked with some of our dairy producers using cheese brine. And really what we're looking to capitalize out of that is that salinity, that salt content. How can we get salt content? The other thing we found through research is a small amount of sugar helps things stick to the road and helps in that chemical reaction with the salt to create heat, which melts the ice. So we're trying all kinds of different things to try to make our highways safer for our traveling public.
Yeah. Dan in Menominee Falls, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to state the fact that there was a recent accident in Waukesha County where a vehicle was following the plow too closely and wound up in front of the plow blade afterward. He was killed. And that's going to affect that plow driver for the rest of his life.
Yeah, vehicles following plows too closely, Robbie.
Something I can't speak strongly enough about. If you're out driving in a snowstorm, and we understand people have to move around and get to work, but give the plow room. There was a tragic accident in Waukesha recently, but it's happened all over the state. In the county I work for, has had an incident similar approximately 5 years ago. In 2021, 2022, that bad winter, we had 16 snowplows struck just in that winter, whether there were a couple head-ons as well as rear-end collisions with people either driving too fast for conditions or not in control of their vehicle. So it's something we ask and we beg of the public to be vigilant of a snowplow. We worked very hard with the Wisconsin legislature in the recent past to allow us to put green lights on our snowplows. What we really want is when you're coming up on us at night and you look ahead and you see that green light, that flashing, we're going to be going a lot slower than you on the highway or on other roads. We typically plow at 20 miles an hour between 20 and 30. So if you're going 40 to 50, you're going to gain on us very quickly. We want you to be able to identify that and just give us some room to work so you're safe in your car.
Yeah. Dan, thank you very much for calling. And I think Dan and Mosini has something that relates here.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. No, he kind of covered the topic, but I'm a former highway department worker. But I was wondering if the presenter, who's doing a great job, if he could talk a little bit and let people know the little tricks of the trade that the plow guys use when it comes to, like, shaded areas on roads that are going to freeze faster or refreeze, something like that, and I'll take the comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, it's amazing. The plow operators in our state make it look easy. When the caller was referring to shaded areas, there's sections along a roadway where maybe the tree cover shades the sun, so you have a bare, wet road for the whole length, and all of a sudden you'll enter a corner and the tree is shading the corner, and we have ice. So what we'll do is we'll also have engaged in what we call anti-icing. So before the storm, if you see us out hitting our bridge decks, our corners, those shaded regions that the caller referred to, we tried to get a small amount of residual salt, as well as sometimes we'll add some trace chemicals like calcium or magnesium, depending where you are, to help that stick to the road. And that prevents that initial moisture or precipitation from sticking to the road and making it slick or dangerous. So we're trying to work in advance, and that's where that local experience really comes into play. Our operators do a tremendous job knowing where that drift's going to be, where there's going to be a bad spot on a corner, and that really aids in the public safety.
Yeah, I remember a guy who was involved with this very thing, a driver who said they used to, in a snow or sleet, to check for black ice. They would kind of touch the or rub their hand on the backside of the rearview mirror or of the side mirror, excuse me. And is that something, Robbie, that you know about?
Yeah, I always joke you're not from Wisconsin if you haven't fell down in a parking lot at some point, because the ice you can't see is the one that gets you. And the one I would refer to as bridge decks. I challenge your listeners as they drive down the freeway this winter, often when you go over a bridge on the interstate and then look in the ditch on the other side, you'll see the marks where a car went into the ditch. And You could be driving down the freeway, and the freeway is wet because of that insulation of the ground. You're going to go over the bridge where the air can cool the underside of the deck, and we get that flash freeze and black ice. The road becomes slippery. So always use caution around those bridge decks and your ramps on and off the freeway. They're great locations where that ice can form quickly.
Joe in Medford, what's on your mind?
Thanks, gentlemen. I'm curious to know a little bit about the backstory, the history of when and why large dead animals were not being removed anymore from the highways of Wisconsin. It seems like little animals they desiccate or are pulverized by cars over time, and more the large animals are left to sort of get disposed of the same way. I'm wondering why that's the case, why there's no longer an effort made to pick up these carcasses and get them off the highway. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, that's a hot button topic across the state. So I can assure you I've received that complaint many times in my career, but I think it was approximately 8 years ago the state switched to bidding this out to a private contractor for their deer pickup. So as an animal gets struck, you have to call your non-emergency dispatch number, report that deer in a location. It gets fed into the system. That system feeds it to the contractor that was the lowest bid to remove those deer from the state system. And then they're supposed to pick those up within 24 hours. Now, I certainly hear the complaints, and I live in it myself, that we often don't see that. Now, the contractor can refuse to pick that up if he deems it an unsafe area, or if it's on the inside lane of a four-lane highway, they won't pick it up. So we have a challenge as a county of how to mitigate those complaints, and often we get sent out way after the fact to try to mitigate some of that. But I hear your complaints, and we would love to see some improvements there as well.
Is the number, is that 511, or is that a different number that you call?
No, your non-emergency number goes to your county dispatch center. So it's just a non-emergency sheriff's response number that you should call and report your deer to.
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking that the 511 is WISDOT offering travel information, road conditions, and weather forecasts, which you can get by dialing 511, I believe.
Which is a you are absolutely correct, and it's a great resource. It's also available online, and it's a good way to know before you go of road conditions in your area.
Yeah. Black ice, Eric wants to know in an email, is it really different from regular ice, or is it just an excuse for people driving too fast for conditions on ice-covered roads? Is the problem the ice or the drivers?
Well, we often define black ice as that ice you can't see, right? It's clear, very translucent, so you can't see it as you approach it. Sometimes on road conditions, there is ice pack that you can see, and you're a little more cautious. But I'll give a great example, even on the freeway, if everyone's running down one lane, just the heat from tires can often create just enough heat to create some moisture, and it can refreeze, causing us to have to redo that maintenance along there just from that heat. So black ice is real. It's something that forms. It's very unpredictable, and it's very challenging.
Yeah. And as I mentioned the other day, I took one step off my porch and hit some black ice, and I think it was about a week and a half ago, and my shoulder's okay now, but my wrist still hurts.
Yeah, like I said, you are not from Wisconsin if you haven't fell down in a parking lot or on a sidewalk.
Oh. So what's in the last 30 seconds, what's your final charge to our drivers?
I just asked them to give our operators room. They're operating in some very difficult, low-visibility conditions, operating a big piece of equipment in and around traffic. Give them extra space. Plan ahead. Give yourself extra time to get to where you're going, and anticipate changing road conditions when you're driving.
Robbie, I hope you can come back and be with us again. This is a great half hour. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to another visit, hopefully down the road.
Well, I would express any time, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk about this, and I hope you have a great holiday season.
You as well, Robbie. Robbie Krejci is the Highway Commissioner for St. Croix County, president of the Wisconsin County Highway Association. Don't forget the chance to talk to Santa Claus tomorrow for your youngsters, whoever they may be, can call us tomorrow from noon to one and talk to Santa Claus and Elf Jingle. We're looking forward to that. Big thanks to everybody today. Of course, you for listening. And we got a team effort here. Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And thank you for listening again. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.